the ever-increasing spread of wealth and income inequality in the country should give everyone pause, because this is not bullish for societal stability. And ultimately, we're all rowing in this boat together. And if society begins to come apart at the seams as people's savings and their ability to provide for their family become threatened by the hidden tax of inflation, there aren't any good outcomes.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty and Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for February 21st through February 28th, 2023, while supplies last. This week we feature 2022 silver maples at $3.40 over spot. Silver maples were the first silver sovereign coins to be minted at 4/9 fine purity, and remain one of the most in-demand and recognized coins today. They come 25 to a tube, 500 to a box, and are available at the lowest premium we've seen in more than a year, at just $3.40 over spot. Canadian maples are also IRA eligible. And if you'd like to learn more about a precious metals IRA, call us and we'll be happy to help you in that process. To order this special or any of the many other options we have available, call us at 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Hey everyone, this is Elijah K. Johnson with Liberty and Finance. And back with us today is our good friend, Doomberg. Thank you so much for joining us today, Doomberg.
Elijah, always great to be with you. And since we usually record on a Friday, that tells me that it's the end of another hard week, and looking forward to the weekend. Hope you are too.
Definitely looking forward to the weekend there. And did want to mention, Doomberg is the number one financial Substack contributor. So we'll put a link in this description here to all your work there. The first topic I did want to discuss is inflation. We'll definitely get into energy later. I know inflation is a key component there, but I did want to ask you about the CPI right now. It seems like it was hotter than expected, the latest number there. But your expectation is that it could be falling later this year, and it could get pretty low. And obviously, a lot of people say that that's a rigged number, but that impacts policy coming out of the Fed. So your perspective on inflation right now, and also how the CPI is reporting it.
Yeah, sure. And it's not something we've written about on the Substack yet, but we did host Stephanie Pomboy, who's a great macro analyst, and she has a fantastic newsletter, Macro Mavens, that she directs mostly towards institutional. And we hosted her for our January Doomberg Pro. We call it the Doom Zoom, our monthly webinar. And she made a pretty compelling mathematical case that, based simply on the comps that are coming up, you know, CPI is measured year over year. And last year, of course, was extreme, pretty robust inflationary numbers that we saw month after month. And then as the calendar rolls over, your comps get a little easier. And her view was that the reported CPI numbers, even though they are sort of changing the definition of how CPI gets measured and reported, she anticipated that the headline numbers would come down pretty substantially throughout the year. And even though the last report was a little hotter, we have seen substantial declines in domestic natural gas prices in the US, for example, and oil is well below the highs. And running against that, of course, used car prices are still coming back up. And so by and large, we do think that we will see ever decreasing reported CPI headline numbers. And whether or not you believe those numbers to be true is not nearly as important as whether the Fed intends to take its cues from those numbers, as you articulated in your question. And we do believe they will. And so the market is also sort of pricing that. If you look at sort of forward interest rate curves and things, that it does seem to, everyone is sort of pricing in the pivot, although the pivot hasn't really come yet. So we shall see. But yeah, I would say based on her analysis and our view of the situation, that at least the headline CPI numbers will, you know, drop below 6 and then 5, maybe even as low as 4 or 3 by mid to late 2023.
And how is this going to impact the American people? Because it seems like on one hand, if, you know, the official inflation number is coming down, but in reality, they're still, you know, possibly looking at, you know, maybe 6-10% inflation if you really look at the cost of living. And then you also have the Fed reacting, which could impact the financial markets. Do you kind of want to walk us through kind of how is this going to impact the average person out there?
Well, inflation is, of course, an insidious tax on savers and pensioners, and disproportionately impacts those near the bottom of the economic pyramid. which is why, you know, it historically speaking, inflation is always and everywhere something to be avoided. It's only a recent phenomenon that we have this, I would say, perversion of central bank policy where we are seeking to create inflation. This, to me, is completely and totally counterproductive to what the average person actually needs. And if you actually study deeper, of course, it only serves to benefit the well-heeled in society and Wall Street and financiers and private equity and so on. It is just another example of the stresses in our society. We are sort of libertarian / capitalistic by instinct over here at Doomberg, but the ever increasing spread of wealth and income inequality in the country should give everyone pause, because this is not bullish for societal stability. And ultimately, we're all rowing in this boat together. And if society begins to come apart at the seams as people's savings and their ability to provide for their family become threatened by the hidden tax of inflation, there aren't any good outcomes. And in fact, if you read sort of historical examples of hyperinflation, societal breakdown is a very, very real and distinct consequence of such actions, whether it's Venezuela in recent times or obviously Weimar Germany. That doesn't make for good times for the vast majority of people, which ultimately, even for the elite, becomes a bit of a threat, because there's only so many bricks from the bottom that you can take and put on top before the whole Jenga wall of societal stability collapses. And we're nowhere near that, of course, in the US. And so at, let's say, real inflation of 6%, 7%, or 8%, this allows the Fed to engineer a relatively soft landing in their view. Time will tell. But it does essentially represent a tax on those who can least afford it, for the benefit of those who have, let's say, relative access.
Now, if we can then, I guess, get your perspective on how this is going to be impacting the energy markets, because that's one of the main topics that you cover on your Substack channel. And it seems like, as we've mentioned before, energy is everything. And that has a huge impact on the general cost of living.
Yeah, we're putting out a piece, hopefully this weekend, maybe Monday, called The Streisand Effect, where we talk about how the European energy crisis, which is undoubtedly abating significantly from the apex of the crisis, thankfully, in large part because the weather has been unseasonably warm in Europe, and they have stockpiled a sufficient amount of coal to get them through the worst case scenario risk that the winter of 22-23 presented. The Streisand effect basically argues that at the apex of the crisis, coal, which was trading for more than oil on an energy equivalent basis, that market signal was really, really telling. And what it tells us is that when push comes to shove, countries around the world will mine for coal, burn coal, stockpile coal, and this will put a damper on energy prices in natural gas or oil or other markets. And what we see now is those prices are sort of equilibrating on an energy content basis. The price of oil, WTI or Brent for Europe, the price of natural gas in Europe and Asia, LNG, and the price of coal with the Newcastle benchmark are all sort of, as you might expect with arbitrage, trading within a narrow band now, whereas they were trading for widely different prices at the peak of the crisis. And so in their effort to decarbonize, the Europeans have provoked the exact opposite effect globally, which is that coal is going to be consumed at record pace. Many, many countries are turning back to coal. The scars of this crisis are causing countries like Indonesia and Pakistan and China to forget about decarbonization and to load up on coal, because coal has one huge advantage. You can stockpile it readily. What does that mean for U.S. markets? It means that the natural gas price in the U.S. has collapsed, as the incremental demand for LNG exports has both been stunted by the Freeport explosion of the LNG export terminal, which is still not operating at full capacity. And oil prices remain relatively elevated. So in the U.S., long story short, with natural gas at $2 per million BTU, inflationary pressures are going to be dampened quite significantly, because energy is a key feedstock into manufactured goods. And even though prices have come down radically, U.S. manufacturers are still advantaged because it is still 7 to 8 times more expensive in Europe and in Asia via LNG. And so a bit of a sort of winding answer, but, you know, coal, we believe, is a sort of Rosetta Stone to explain how the crisis was abated and how to look at energy markets going forward.
Now, is this good news then? Because it sounds like we're seeing a decrease then in, you know, the cost of natural gas. So that should be, I guess, a good thing for the average American out there. Or how do you look at this?
It is unabashedly a great thing for the average American, because it means energy is more accessible and therefore energy is life. And the inflationary pulses that we saw in 2022 were in large part driven by these incredible energy prices that we saw globally. And so to the extent that inflation is bad and energy is life, low energy costs and taming inflation are both unabashedly good. And we cheer them both. And as we said all along, as much as we were flagging the crisis as it evolved, our strong desire was that Europe would make it through the winter. And it seems like they have, and that is a good thing. And so to the extent that markets have calmed, and inflation is coming back in a little bit, this undoubtedly benefits the very same consumers that we were talking about who were the victims of inflation, which is the everyday blue collar worker, working paycheck to paycheck and paying their bills. Heating costs at $2 per million BTU natural gas are far more manageable than heating costs at $10 per million BTU natural gas in the US. And heaven forbid we, you know, ever see the types of prices that Europe saw, which is up to $100 per million BTU intraday apex price at the apex of the crisis. And so absolutely fantastic thing, except for the natural gas producers, of course. But for everyone who uses natural gas, like the chemical production downstream and heavy manufacturing in the US and fertilizer producers and so on, nothing could be better than natural gas prices coming back down.
Now, when it comes to diesel, this viewer is wanting to know updates on your previous pieces, the diesel outlook, and also the global food situation.
So to the extent that low natural gas prices have taken pressure off of, we'll answer the second part first, the global food situation. That is actually, of course, just a very good thing. And we shall see. There's still certain crops that are pretty elevated in price. But if I'm just pulling up as we're talking, you know, the 3-to-1 crack spread, which is a measure of really the diesel crisis in our view, it peaked at almost $60 a barrel in June, July, and is now down to much more manageable and historically reasonable $25. And so that tells us that the market signals that were sent out during the peak of the crisis have done their job, which has triggered new supply and or destroyed demand to the point where things have become more manageable. On diesel in particular, there is a little bit of a sleight of hand going on here with the Russian sanctions, of course, which is this oil is finding its way to India, where it's being refined into finished products like gasoline and diesel, and then obviously finds its way to the US and international markets via India. And so to the extent that we're kind of playing hide the ball here on Russian oil. The incremental demand has been soaked up by countries willing to circumvent the sanctions, or at least not participate in them, like India.
Now, we have a few viewers' questions we could tie in here, but I'd like to start with this one from Mark asking about the derailment in Ohio. How will the chemicals that were burned from the train derailment in Ohio affect the food supply?
The short answer is effectively not at all. We wrote a piece called Railroaded, and in that piece, I should say, we made it free to all readers, and we did not put it behind the paywall, given the public safety concerns of the event. It is very challenging to stand into the wave of hyperbole and say, hey, this is not nearly as bad as people are making it out to be, without sounding like you're minimizing a very serious situation. And to the locals, this was indeed a very serious situation. And as we said in the piece, if we lived there, we would be furious, panicked, angry, hesitant to go home. And we would be talking to lawyers looking to sue everybody involved. But for everybody outside of, say, a 5-mile radius of that event, this is not a significant event in our view whatsoever. And what we did in the piece Railroaded is we went detail by detail, car by car, what was in the tanker or the hopper or the rail car, what happened to it, and what it means. And when you boil it down, something like a little over 100,000 gallons of vinyl chloride was burned. And when you see the big black smoke cloud going vertical up into the atmosphere, that is that event. You know, there's a lot of confusion in the reporting because when the train first derailed, there was a fire. And we detailed what was burned in that fire. And then 3 days later, they did a controlled detonation, essentially, of the five rail cars of vinyl chloride, which then created that black plume that everybody sees and has become sort of the iconic photograph of the event. That plume going straight up in the air is exactly what you want. So that means, you know, the combustion products of these five rail cars of vinyl chloride got diluted into the atmosphere. And essentially, the old phrase is not to be flippant, is the solution to pollution is dilution. And in the atmosphere, because you're talking about volumes, dilution scales to the power of three. And so we said in our piece, you know, you can fit 1,000 1 mile cubes in a 10 mile cube. That's how, you know, quickly these things dilute. And so by and large, this event has come and gone. It is a serious event for the people of East Palestine. And they have every right to feel violated. There are very few more powerful violations of one's individual sovereignty than a violation of your home. And we equate this to the equivalent of, say, a break-in. Like if you come home to a break-in, you feel this place of safety and security and family and love and kindness has been violated. That is the same feeling that every resident of East Palestine justifiably should be feeling these days. But for the rest of the country, at the sort of regional and national level, this is a, let's say, we have far more significant chemical releases in the industry on a weekly or monthly basis than this. This has become very high profile because it's become political. And the pictures look truly disastrous. If you went to East Palestine today, as President Trump did yesterday, you would see that basically most of life has gone back to normal. But again, I'm not saying these things to minimize what it means for the people of East Palestine. But if you're asking me whether the controlled burning of five rail cars of vinyl chloride is a material impact on the nation's food supply, I would be vehement in my answer that it is a decided no.
I think one of the things, and one of the reasons that, you know, we're in the alternative media, sometimes the mainstream media can really focus on exactly the wrong thing, right? And it sounds like in this situation, there is a lot of hyperbole in the reporting of this. So is there any principles that you guys go by or that our viewers may be able to take home looking at maybe the mainstream? Maybe part of it is just, you know, don't pay attention to the mainstream media, but any principles that you work by to kind of figure out, okay, you know, this isn't as big of a story as the mainstream is making it, or this isn't a concern to me, maybe.
So let's state up front, it's Doomburg. If we legitimately thought there was real doom here beyond local, but at the regional and national level, we would be the first and among the more qualified to articulate that doom. And we have written pieces that people have accused us of being alarmist. And in hindsight, perhaps some of them were. At that time, we wrote them as a warning and with the hope that this wouldn't happen. And in many cases, it didn't. In some cases, it did. And so with that backdrop, it just happens to be coincidentally that this is a technology area where we have pretty deep expertise on the team. And we knew what was involved and what wasn't involved. And we did our own original research. We found this this PDF file on the EPA's website, I think before any other mainstream media reported on it, although I could be wrong. Certainly, I didn't see it in sort of the superficial coverage that you would see on television. And then we just did a detailed analysis of what was in each rail car. And so one of the big drivers of fear is a lack of knowledge. And with a lack of knowledge, you could be susceptible to believing almost anything. Hey, you know, like this is a Chernobyl, which was some of the great hyperbole. So in our view, our number one principle to answer your question is we always write what we believe to be true in the moment when we write it. And we would never write something that we don't believe to be true just for the sake of, you know, clicks or eyeballs. And unfortunately, here, what we saw was a complete and total polarization around politics. So this very quickly evolved from a legitimate spill that has local impacts to a political indictment on President Biden and his Secretary of Transportation. And once it hardened into the sort of team sport politics, which so taints so much of our discourse, it became incumbent upon us to at least write this piece, put it out there, make it free for everybody to read, and share our knowledge and expertise in this area. Again, trying to walk that fine line between very serious for some people, but not a national catastrophe as it's being played out. And once it became a political team sport, Elijah, it then had to become a bigger and bigger problem, because then this is how you score your political points. I'll close with one particular example of what I would call sort of propaganda sleight of hand. Jesse Waters of Fox News, who is, you know, among the people who was hyping this in the days after it became a national story, talking about whether the water was, quote, safe to drink in East Palestine. And then cutting to a clip of somebody scraping the bottom of a creek and showing that there's, you know, oily material in that creek, as though people are taking their buckets and going to a creek to get their drinking water. This is not how it works. Of course, the local waters are going to be contaminated. As we described in the piece, a lot of materials were dumped into the ground, and most of them are biodegradable, and they'll take their time to work their way through and so on. But water, if you don't have a well, is produced at a factory with release specs that then go into a pipe that is enclosed that ends up in your home. And the water was being tested. Now, look, if you have a well, it's a different story. You'd want to be concerned that depending on the depth of your well, you want to do some testing, maybe put an RO membrane filter on your well, as we advised one resident to do who reached out to us after our piece. But by and large, this deception of there's an oily material in a creek near the rail tracks means that you shouldn't consider drinking the water out of your tap seems to imply that the water in your tap comes from that creek, when we all know that it doesn't. Like, municipal water producing facilities are the equivalent of factories. They have inputs and they have outputs and they have specifications and they have professionals and they test and they drink the water themselves, the employees at these factories. And so that's the type of thing that motivated us to write the piece. We understand the sort of team sports dynamics of politics and all its ugliness. But in this instance, we didn't feel that such hyperbole was justified. And we, frankly, put the Doomberg brand at risk to take that stand.
We do have a question here from Caleb about the BRICS nations and Saudi Arabia. I know you have talked a lot about this. They are wanting to know, what are the consequences of BRICS nations challenging the dollar, especially if they sell and dump all of their dollars? And how does Saudi's decision, like joining the BRICS or non-dollar exclusivity, how could that all play in?
So this is a challenging one to answer with some precision. I will say, historically, whenever there has been a serious challenge to U.S. dollar hegemony, there has coincidentally, perhaps, almost always followed significant wars. And we predicted, you know, in our 2023 predictions, which is always a dangerous thing to do, but we had some fun with our pro subscribers in December, that that the challenge of the BRICS nation would ultimately lead to an escalation in the conflict between China and Taiwan. Just call it a hunch. And what we see today, even with the Wall Street Journal, that the U.S. is planning to quadruple its force level in Taiwan, which I suspect President Xi would consider to be a serious crossing of his red lines. And he would at least view that as a significant provocation. And so we shall see. Interesting news with, you know, Iraq and the de-dollarization of their commerce with China came out this week, which is kind of a fascinating place for such talk to come from, considering how much blood and treasure the U.S. has spilt in Iraq over the decades. And so we shall see. You know, that there are a lot of very powerful forces behind maintaining the U.S. dollar as the global reserve. And so we wouldn't be flippant about predicting the end of the U.S. dollar. It is just a series of milestones that we're watching very carefully, especially with the guide of history as I said at the beginning of this answer, which is, generally speaking, perhaps a series of great coincidences, kinetic conflict usually doesn't follow too far behind serious attempts to get off the U.S. dollar, especially for energy transactions and so on.
All right. Well, Doomberg, thank you so much for your time today. Before I let you go, are there any last thoughts you had for our viewers, and where can they find you online?
Yeah, I would just say, as much as we're Doomberg, we try to be optimistic, and let's, of course, pray for peace and pray for economic prosperity for all of your viewers and listeners. And you can find all of our work at doomberg.substack.com. We publish 6 to 8 pieces per month. We are 100% subscriber supported, which has been a fantastic business model for us, because it gives us the freedom to be provocative when we feel like we need to be, and to hold true to our own editorial freedom. And so if you're interested in becoming a regular Doomberg reader, head on over to doomberg.substack.com. You can sign up for free, and what free gets you is sort of the first third of all of our pieces. And our objective there is to sort of entice you over time to say, wow, this is probably worth paying for. And so that's the sort of customer journey. Sign up for free, check out our previews. And then if we earn your business, then you can go ahead and subscribe. So Elijah, always great. I'm looking forward to coming back. And I do love these audience questions. Maybe we should do a whole show with just audience questions. That'd be fun.
I think that'd be very fantastic there. I just put this out an hour before we got on, and there were plenty of questions there. We didn't have time to get to them all today. But Doomberg, once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Indeed. Thanks. Have a great weekend, Elijah.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.